Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody, welcome to The Tom Woods Show, episode 2428. I'm very glad to be here with Peter St. Ange, who is an economist with the Heritage Foundation and an all-around great guy, super knowledgeable. If you follow him on Twitter, and I keep telling guests one at a time, for me, in my heart, it's always Twitter. You know, I never stopped calling Myanmar Burma. So that's just the way it is with old Woods. But all the same, if you follow him there, and I'll put his follow link in the description of the video and on the show notes page, you're going to get some super, super great content. Nice, brief, punchy videos that don't take half your day, but you can immediately get something really, really valuable from a good guy who, by the way, can take good news and bad news with the same kind of stoic, unperturbed response. I don't know how he does it, but Peter, welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you, Tom. And that was a beautiful introduction. Thank you for that. The check is in the mail for that one. Yep. Really appreciate it.
Well, my pleasure. So we're going to do a bit of a hodgepodge kind of potpourri episode today, but I want to start with something that is on everybody's minds. And this is something that, I guarantee you, I mean, there is nothing more certain in the world than that I am going to get an email from Gene Epstein at the end of this episode. Absolute guarantee.
But I get those too. He doesn't send me the emails, but he corrects me on Twitter all the time.
Okay, I get both. I get Twitter and the personal email. But I've been trying to push Gene when I've had him on to acknowledge that younger people just starting out, I don't think they're just whining when they say they have it harder than they should or harder than their parents did. Now, I recognize that they have many advantages over their parents. The technology is much, much better. I personally think that despite the financial difficulties some of them have with rising prices and housing prices and so on, I still think they have, in some ways, more opportunities than their parents did. Mm-hmm. But I fully recognize that things are difficult. And yet, Gene keeps pushing back against me, saying this is anecdotal, it's an exaggeration, that yes, he doesn't deny housing prices are up, and he doesn't deny that some people are struggling, but some people have always been struggling. Now, you this week posted something about an interesting figure, $41,000. What was that $41,000 in reference to?
Yeah, so that's new data from the Social Security Agency, and that is their tally for the median income for an American worker. In other words, half of American workers make less than that, $41,000. And that comes out to, about $3,400 a month. Now, once you take the median rent in the United States is about $2,000. The median car payment for a used car is about $542, I think. Once you're done with that, you've got about $892 left, and you've got to do your groceries, your gasoline, the car repairs, the health insurance, clothes, any kind of sick kids. You've got to cover all of that with $892. And so I'm sympathetic to Gene that in many ways, life is much better than it was in the past. But at the same time, point one is that a lot of people, I think, are genuinely struggling. This is not just lazy millennials. This is literally, they are in a spot where they can essentially only dream of the lifestyle that they themselves grew up in, right? So they might have grown up in a four-bedroom house that their parents owned. And when they look at that now and they're getting into their 40s, they're with the roommates, they're eating ramen, that's just a complete like science fiction outcome for them. They can't imagine getting there. They're light years from starting a family. And so, yes, we have iPhones, we have internet, we have all kinds of technological innovation because the rest of us innovate, even as the government tries to stop it. But at the same time, the question is, have we lost that sort of American dream trajectory where each generation is much, much wealthier than their parents, right? To the point where the parents look at the kids and say, I can't imagine what an amazing world you live in. We couldn't imagine that. We had to go uphill both ways in the snow. All right. And that has now become today where you've got 30-somethings who are dreaming nostalgically of the luxurious lifestyle in which they grew up.
All right, let me play devil's advocate a little bit here. Yeah. So if $41,000 is the median income for a person And the stats say that for people 15 years old and over. So
right.
That means two people who are at the median, 15 years old and over, and living together have $82,000, which suddenly doesn't sound
right.
Too impossible. But then also, how much are these people working? Among the poorest fifth of the population, only one-third of people who are age eligible to work actually do work. And a lot of people work part-time. So if you look at median earnings of full-time workers, then the annual figure becomes $58,000. Now, I don't want to live on $58,000, but I'd have a lot easier time living on that than $41,000. Does that change anything for you?
Yeah, the two incomes, I think, definitely does. If you've got two people making, even if you just double the median worker and you're looking at 82, then absolutely life is a lot easier that way. You can't actually afford to buy a house. You can have luxuries. You can take vacations. But is that happening, I think, is part of the issue. So we may see a renaissance in sort of traditional family styles where you've got two parents working. Now, it's a separate question, of course, that decades ago, you could raise a family in a comfortable lifestyle with one person working. But nonetheless, right, it's a fair point that if people would actually get married, and you may indeed see that with some of these millennials. You know, I think when you look at the videos online, they seem to be still sort of thinking in the mind frame that they grew up in, this sort of atomistic, every man or woman for themselves, where they're imagining that they have to be responsible for their own financial destiny. They have to create their own career, pay their own bills. And that may be the upshot here, is that people are encouraged to go back to that more traditional lifestyle.
I saw, and in fact, I think I might have it open in one of my tabs here, from a few months ago. This is on CNBC. Headline, 63% of workers unable to pay a $500 emergency expense.
Yeah.
What does that look like? How do people... You're on the edge of catastrophe at all times. And that has to take a toll on you mentally.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and the amazing thing, of course, so I was living in Taiwan for about 5 years. And what's interesting about Taiwan is that the average household wealth in Taiwan, I believe it's actually substantially higher than it is in the US. Now, Taiwan is a much poorer country. So why is that? And I would argue that the reason is because the safety net in Taiwan is not nearly as complete or as generous as it is in the US. And so what ends up happening is, in Taiwan, for example, if you lose your job, people don't ask if you're going to go on government benefits, right? People ask, well, what kind of business are you going to start in the meantime? Okay, the assumption is that you're going to go down and rent a food cart, all right? You're going to take that out somewhere. You can pay rent to find a spot in these night markets, very cheap. You'll pay $50 to get a sign made, and you'll be up and running that evening earning income whilst you look for a job during the day. Okay, it's a completely different mentality. Whereas I think the $500, right, the fact that in a nation this wealthy, that 63% cannot afford people are like driving on the edge of the cliff all the time. And I think a big reason for that is the safety net, right? It is that we've created moral hazard where people do not save enough. They spend way up to the limit. They figure they'll just go on credit and then something will happen. So yeah, I think without a doubt. And of course, the upshot for policy is that any politician who would propose some of the sort of tough medicine type policies, you know, Jim Grant talks about in The Forgotten Depression, the sort of standard recession response back in the 19th century. Anybody who talks like that, you are going to have the media trolling up millions of people who are suffering, those exact people who are living right on the edge. And at that point, there is going to be no tolerance in the public conversation for discussions about personal responsibility. People are going to think, well, okay, sure, in the abstract, we can talk about that when the recession is over. And so the end result is that every crisis, I think, grows. You have this ratchet effect that is much larger than it would be if we didn't have such an expansive welfare state.
All right. So the welfare state contributes in some way. But if somebody said to you, all of this struggling that we're doing goes to show that the system doesn't work, you might well agree with them, because it depends on what you mean by the system. But what they mean by the system is, quote unquote, capitalism. And capitalism doesn't work.
Yep.
But the thing is that historically, for hundreds of years, capitalism, the result of it, has been to bring, thinking in terms of purchasing power, the price of everything more and more within the reach of ordinary people. So why would the system suddenly reverse course? So how would you defend the market economy that you and I believe in?
Right. So capitalism, of course, means different things to different people. So the left uses it to mean the sort of perfect free market orthodoxy, every man for himself, the law of the jungle. And I think as Austrians, we understand that if we're talking about the current system, that is, of course, a mixture. It is an enormous amount of government interference. Government at all levels spends about half of all the spending in the American economy. If you add on what's regulated, what's mandated, we are a mostly socialist system. And so, you know, I think the common ground, sort of the opportunity, is that when we see things that offend everybody, okay, so people who can't afford life-saving treatments, the 2008 bailouts, right? When we see those things, left and right, we can agree that these are perverse outcomes. So at that question, or at that point, the question is just to sit down and say, okay, precisely why did this happen, right? Was this government trying to play the referee and trying to keep the world working smoothly, and it was just the bad guys, the bankers, did something wrong or tried to go around them? Or on the other hand, is this consistent with our point of view, which is that there's this unholy alliance between companies and the government? And so that's why we have these perverse outcomes. So, you know, I think on the bright side, I think that both left and right agree what the problems are, right? So we know that inflation is a problem. We know bailouts are a problem. There's not a large number of Americans who think that it's healthy, let's say, that the government keeps bailing out banks. So we do agree that there are problems, and we agree what they are substantially. At that point, it's just a question of sort of sitting down and working out, okay, why are these happening? Why do they keep happening? What kind of reforms could fix them?
Hey, everybody, I have a message for all you book addicts out there from our sponsor, Blinkist. You know as well as I do that no sooner have you and I finished one book than we've gone out and purchased two more. So how are we ever going to get a handle on all this and get the information in there into the old noggin? Well, the Blinkist app can help. With Blinkist, you can absorb huge amounts of information, information that satisfies your natural curiosity, as well as the kind of information that can make you more successful in business and in life. We're talking dozens of nonfiction categories. Blinkist condenses each book into 15-minute summaries you can read or listen to. And so for some books, you'll listen to what they call the blink, the 15-minute summary, and you'll say, I definitely want to read this whole thing. For other books, you'll say, you know, that 15 minutes was just about enough. Well, if you have a half-hour commute each way, you can absorb the equivalent of 4 books. You think that might make you a more impressive person? And you'll find in there libertarian classics, works by Rothbard and Friedman, and even, dare we say, a work from old Woods here. Well, right now, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/Woods to start your 7-day free trial and get 25% off a Blinkist premium membership. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/Woods to get 25% off and a 7-day free trial. Blinkist.com/Woods. And now for a limited time, you can even use Blinkist Connect to share your premium account. You'll get 2 premium subscriptions for the price of 1. I want to shift to, because we have a lot of things to talk about, because you talk about so many things, I'm trying to keep up with them all. There's another thing that comes up a lot, of course, obviously the situation with the national debt. And I think every time I bring somebody on who talks about that, I say, I think a lot of Americans are not that concerned about that because they think, as long as I can remember, people have been warning me about the national debt, and it doesn't seem to matter.
Yeah.
So it's starting to turn into climate change. You know, climate change is going to end mankind. But if it ends mankind 3 million years from now, that's not really relevant to me. So is there a tipping point, or is there some statistic we can keep an eye on? Is there something that happens? Because obviously there does come a level at which there are obviously serious problems. But who knows when that is? What should we be looking for? Why is it a serious problem? Why do you think about it when so many other people don't?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. For decades, the sort of standard assumption, I believe it was based on a paper by Reinhardt, or including Reinhardt. Anyway, the standard assumption was that around about 100 or 125% of GDP, you were hitting into this sort of catastrophic danger zone. That's 100% of GDP in debt. And Japan blew through that in 1998. Right. And nothing that dramatic happened. You can argue that they had slow growth after that, but I mean, they did not implode. They didn't go back to Mad Max, Warlords era. And that gave, I think, a lot of sort of false sense of security. But at the same time, well, and then it begs the question, right? You know, when we keep talking about debt, are they lies, right? Can we just keep going on forever? Voters seem to think that, right? If you look at Biden's student loan bailout, for example, so that was, I guess, 700 odd billion. That was directly out of taxpayers' pockets, right? That was one of the biggest assets that the federal government owned. So that belonged to taxpayers or American. And everybody seemed totally cool with just basically lighting that on fire and giving it away to somebody else. I think the reason is because of that, where people do not think that the debt is real. In the abstract, yeah, sure, they see $34 trillion, but it doesn't feel real to them. So at what point does it become real? And I think a nice data point there is Greece in 2009, right? So during the European sovereign debt crisis, Greece was threatening to default on its external debt. What's interesting about Greece is that as a percent of GDP, Greece at that moment was lower than the US was at that moment. But what happened is that Greece had an election and they had a candidate who was floating default. He was complaining about German bankers, and inevitably a lot of the foreign debt is going to be owned by foreigners or it's going to be owned by bankers. And these are the two most unsympathetic groups in any election. And then at that point, what you had, bond yields soaring. And so it was becoming harder for Greece to access capital markets. That's when it became a crisis. Okay, it didn't become a crisis because of how much Greece was paying in debt service. It didn't even become a crisis because of how much debt there was per se. Okay, how it became a crisis was he had this political entrepreneur. So where did he come from? And there, it was really the austerity debate that was going on in Greece at the time, right? So Greece was starting to have problems accessing capital markets. They were having a discussion where they said, okay, the money doesn't grow on trees. It's not endless. We have to start cutting back on spending. And at that point, it became real for voters. Right before then, it was just these abstract billions and billions. And well, Germany will take care of it. Who knows? Future generations. But once it becomes real. And so I think that that's exactly what happens here, is that sort of the good news is that we can keep going for a while longer. Okay, we can keep stacking it up. But the bad news is that I think that the limit, whether it's 125 or 100%, it's actually quite a bit lower than that, because the question is, do you have some political entrepreneur who sees an opportunity to float, stiffing Chinese, stiffing Wall Street? That is always attractive, right? If you're a political entrepreneur and you're walking to the election, everybody's talking about debt, and you say, okay, you guys want to make a quick $34 trillion? Now, of course, we would have to issue new debt to cover the widows and orphans, the sympathetic, whether it's Social Security or government pensions or personal pensions. A lot of 401k money might be invested in treasury. So yes, you would need additional debt to cover those politically sympathetic groups. But if we take any national debt, but including the US national debt, a large proportion of those holders are going to be very unsympathetic politically. And so it's basically a free lunch for any candidate who wants to start floating default on the debt. So I think in practice, if we look at 2009 Greece, and then we look at, say, 1998 Japan, that's kind of the question, right? Can we keep going like this and just keep stacking and stacking and stacking, perhaps because the US dollar is reserve currency and the worse things get, you start to get a crisis mentality worldwide and then people actually demand more dollars. By the way, that's exactly what happened in 2008. So that's kind of the good outcome. Or are we headed towards the bad one where we are opening up this inevitable debate about austerity, and then that debate is then going to create this opportunity for some political entrepreneur to come in and start discussing those kinds of radical changes.
You had a video which you talked about the debt situation in the US with an interesting fact that nearly half of the income tax receipts are going to service existing federal debt. How can that be?
It's astounding. Yeah, we're already up to that number. I think they're on track to about $1 trillion this year and $1 trillion of debt service. And then, of course, on top of that, we have $2 trillion of fresh deficits. That's about double last year. I've got some funny numbers on it because of the accounting for the student loan moratorium. But fundamentally, you know, we are doubling our deficit. $1 trillion in the old days was a lot of money. And on top of that, now we've got $1 trillion in the interest on old debt. You put those together and it is an overwhelming number. But more important, it is growing very fast, right? Not only because of the additional debt, but just because of where interest rates are. So we have an enormous amount of federal debt that was it was incurred when interest rates were very low. So interest rates have been near close to zero for most of the past 15 years since 2008 crisis. And so that's very cheap debt. You might have 0.8% interest rate. And now that has to be replaced. And interest rates are far, far higher now. And so if you've got to replace, say, 1% debt with 4% debt, you are, even for the exact same number of dollars, you are now paying a ton more in interest on that. So those two together, right? It would be one thing if we were actually paying down debt, okay? Because then we could say, sure, it's higher interest rates, but that's cost of doing business. You got a Federal Reserve. It's fine. We're paying it off. But we're actually doing both at the same time. So we're incurring much higher rates on the debt along with additional debt. And then we've got this kind of extra moving part here. And this has been discussed a lot by Janet Yellen, among others, which is that there appears to be some kind of risk premium beyond investors betting on what the Fed's going to do next. There seems to be some sort of risk premium that's starting to accrue to government debt. And typically that's going to happen, right? If that's completely separate from inflation, that's going to be actually people starting to ask the question, is it possible that there could be some sort of default in the US, whether that's, you know, a so-called soft default via inflation or a hard default by, you know, actually renegotiating terms. When you see that sort of autonomous risk premium coming in there, that is very concerning. And indeed, if your debt interest is soaring, the amount you're paying, if the interest rate is soaring, and if your new debt is soaring on top of that, then you would expect that.
Let's say a little something about ongoing price inflation. There was a tweet that Biden put out. I know you saw it because you commented on it, but we all saw it. He was indirectly threatening companies by saying, now that prices are coming down, but what he really means is prices are rising more slowly. Then you need to not gouge consumers by keeping your prices up high. You know, give us a break.
Yeah.
Now, apart from, and I would like to talk in a minute about the dumb economics of that, but I'm just thinking in terms of an industry like the restaurant industry. I was just seeing an article the other day about how difficult it is now to take your family out to dinner because of the prices. And obviously, a restaurant meal, there are a lot of substitutes for that. The main one is making your own dinner at home. People can easily substitute into that. And if this were just a matter of the restaurants are taking advantage of everybody, they would stop doing that immediately because they would like to see people not abandon their industry. But you will start seeing that if these prices don't come under control. So the idea that there's a conspiracy to keep prices up because we have wicked people who wear monocles and walk around carrying sacks of money with dollar signs on them running the economy is extremely low IQ.
Yes. Yes, and it's par for the course. As you know, every time they screw it up, first they'll minimize, you know, they say, no, no, it's all in your head, or they'll say it's all under control. And then next thing you're going to see is they're going to go after the scapegoats. And the problem is that for voters, the part of inflation that they see that they can touch is when the price act, you know, it used to be a dollar meal, now it's a dollar a quarter. So that is the part they can touch. That's like the last mile of the inflation assembly line. And so it is very easy to go after that and to characterize those guys as just greedy capitalists. And of course, every time that we've gone that route, right? So Nixon had price controls in the 1970s. FDR had a whole empire of price controls in the Depression. And when you start doing that, you are really sort of going from just bumbling, like the government screwing things up, to actually predators on industries. That is when things can get very catastrophic. And, you know, I'm sure you get asked this question too, but people might ask, like, yes, we might have a recession coming here. It could be stagflation, but are we looking at another depression? And there, at least, you know, what I normally answer is, well, the question is, how intrusive is the government going to be? Is the government going to come in and micromanage companies and dictate the wage rates or the prices? And if we do start down that road, and I don't think that this is a high risk, but these kinds of tweets where, you know, Biden's scapegoating companies and sort of implicitly threatening to crack down on them, if we do go down that route, then yes, I think that we are absolutely trotting the path laid down by FDR.
It's incredible the way they propagandize about rising prices. It's always, they have to blame somebody else.
Yeah. We have seen it. I mean, during the pandemic, we had the boat in the Suez, and then we had too many Pelotons, and Elizabeth Warren was going after big grocery, big meat, I mean, it's just endless. You know, you had China with the thing, and then you had the Ukraine war, of course.
Oh, but Peter, don't forget the most recent one was just this week, and I nominated it for the prize of dumbest headline of 2023. And the thing is, it's hard to limit the nominations. And
once
you get the nominations, though, it's hard to choose one. But in my heart, Peter, they're all winners. But this particular, this headline was from The Atlantic, and it was "Inflation is your fault." Did you see that?
I have a video coming out on that. Yes, probably by the time this posts. Yes, that was absolutely priceless. And oh man, that was
it's because consumers are spending. You know?
Oh, they had 20 excuses. My goodness. Here, I got the script right here. What was it? okay, the pandemic did the thing, and then it was the amazing job market, and then there were too many amusement park trips. And then people had too much money. And then there was a, quote, raft of studies how price sensitivity might be changing over time. And then finally, there was a philosophical passage about brand loyalty creating inertia and whether that's a good thing. It was like, literally, they had an intern just go through the past 3 years and like, you got to come up with something, kiddo. It's insane.
You know what would be interesting? If they would at least say one of the contributing factors might be the central bank. You know, the one institution that can create trillions of dollars, that might be one of them. But it's not even in the list. How could it not be on the list? How could it not even be on the list?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, it's like they're covering up for it. And I hate to talk that way because I think some of these people are too dumb to be in on a conspiracy. But you don't even mention the money creation machine?
It's astounding. Yeah, it's absolutely astounding. Right.
I mean, what they could say, I'm sorry to keep interrupting, but they could say, look, the crazy right wingers try to blame it all on the Fed. You know, we have to admit the Fed plays a role, but there's also these other things.
It's
we didn't even get that.
Yeah. Nope. Yeah. No, it's astounding. And you know, you've got children. If there's a broken lamp and you ask them what happened, and they're like, well, okay, it's funny because there's about 12 reasons, and let me just go through them. And you're like, one excuse, maybe, but once you pass one, no, I'm not buying it anymore.
It's not, my kids are too direct and honest for that to work. You know, it doesn't occur to them even to try. So if they were reporting on inflation, they'd come right out and say it's the Fed, and that'd be the end of it.
Yeah.
Hey, everybody, it's a message from Old Woods here. Now, you know that a lot of content creators have Patreon or whatever, and you also may remember when you were little, those PBS fund drives, if you donated, they gave you like an umbrella. I think it's bad luck for me to actually have this umbrella open in the house. Well, I'm here to tell you, you don't need any of that because you should become a member of the Tom Woods Supporting Listeners Program because you get way more than a crummy umbrella and way more than anybody else is giving you. So for example, even the lowest contribution level gets you every month in the physical mail. Remember the physical mail? My 16-page newsletter. That's right. It's not the same as the emails. It's all fresh, original content. 100 octane woods. Yes, I know that's not correct usage. I don't care. 100 octane woods delivered to your mailbox every single month. Okay, so that's the first thing. Second thing, you know I host murder mystery dinner parties all over the country. Well, you know what? If you're a supporting listener of the Tom Woods Show, you can go to those for free. You don't have to pay one extra cent. You become a member also of the Tom Woods Show Elite, which is my no-censorship group, which, by the way, helped to keep a lot of people sane during COVID. You get transcripts of all the interviews I do. You get an invite to my Christmas party, which features a guest speaker and a dinner prepared in my home by a chef. And that's just what you get at the lowest level. So don't spend your life asking yourself what might have been. Go to supportinglisteners.com right now and be a part of all the awesomeness. So, all right, so let's talk about a topic I just did an episode on last week. I had two people on to talk about Javier Milei in Argentina. It was our friend, maybe you know Jacob Hubert, but he was visiting Argentina at the time. And then we had university student who's written for Mises.org quite a few times who lives down there. And I got a really, really good overview from people who are not naive. You know, these aren't people who thought Bill Weld was going to really light things on fire. Like these are people who have standards and they really had good things to say. But I think his platform is not difficult to follow, but Monetary policy is always confusing to the average person because no one teaches it to them and no one talks about it. So if he says, I'm going to shut down the central bank, well, that's music to my ears. But I, of course, would like to see a much more radical approach taken than what he has in mind, because he wants to attach Argentina to the U.S. dollar. And the thing is, I doubt there's a stomach in Argentina for a more radical approach than that, which is what I would want to do, which is just either a gold standard or let the market handle it or whatever. But what exactly would this look like? And do you think it's a good thing for them, even if it's not the best thing?
Yeah, and I agree with you. It's always a question of whether the perfect is the enemy of the good. So, but right, what he's proposing, as you say, is to swap out the Argentine peso and instead use the US dollar. Something that El Salvador and Ecuador did fairly recently in 2000, 2001. It's not crazy. Both of those countries did it with relatively normal governments. They were both center-right, but they were not chainsaw-wielding Ron Paul fans. So I think that's very doable to throw out the peso and keep the US dollar. Now, El Salvador and Ecuador both still have central banks. They're shrunken, you know, shadows of what they used to be, because if you don't have a currency, then A, you can't spawn inflation. You actually have to buy your dollars from somebody. So from El Salvador's perspective, the dollar may as well be gold. They actually have to trade real things to get a hold of dollars. And of course, that also means that you can't print money to bail out your local banks, right? So for those two reasons, I think it is grand to get rid of a local currency. Ideally, as you say, you would go to something stable like gold. But in this case, if we consider how incompetent Argentina has really been on monetary policy, and it really has been like a world champion, they've had five hyperinflation since 1975, which I don't know if that's a record, but that's impressive. So if they're trading the local confetti for the US dollar, then yes, I think it's a huge improvement. Going by Ecuador and El Salvador, it's fairly likely to happen. It's easy for people to understand. A lot of Argentinians are already dollarized as it is, right? They save in US dollars, they transact in US dollars, certainly in black markets. So I think that there's a good chance that would happen. Now, that is different from getting rid of the central bank, which was kind of the platform. And they're fundamentally, aside from controlling the currency and bailing out banks, that's 80, 90% of the juice that you get from a central bank in the first place. Right, they have some other supervisory roles, supervising interbank payments and credit card systems and things like that, is relatively trivial. Moreover, realistically, any country that is integrated with other countries is going to have to keep doing that. We can dream of a future where US goes to gold and then everybody else normalizes to that. But in this day and age, realistically, if he quote unquote shuts down the Argentinian central bank, then I would imagine that's all just switch over to the Ministry of Finance, and not that much is going to change. So really, I think the key thing isn't necessarily whether he closes the bank. The key thing is, does he get rid of the currency? If he does and goes to the US dollar, I think that would be a dramatic improvement for Argentina. But of course, it's not nearly as far as you and I would like, which is to actually switch out the gold. It also, I think, raises an interesting question, which is that as the fiat system collapses, it's called the milkshake theory by Santiago Capital. But as the fiat system collapses, you may get this perverse result where the reserve asset actually gets stronger. It's basically absorbing the corpses of every weaker currency as it disappears on that road to Ragnarok. So I think we're already seeing that. We are getting more and more countries that are dollarizing. If not formally, then they are informally. So I think that as we go towards that kind of final moment, when the US dollar collapses, I think absolutely it will get stronger on the way there, which will be perverse.
I did not realize until quite recently, because of his repeated quotations of Mises and citations of Rothbard, and I understand he even cited Bob Murphy's book, Chaos Theory, in a public debate.
He did.
That's incredible. I love Bob, but within the pantheon of Austrian works, that's one of the more obscure ones.
Yep.
So if he knows that, that's very impressive.
Right.
But because of that, I didn't realize that in his economic thinking, he's more Chicago than Austria, but he likes the political thought of people associated with the Austrians. So my view is, if politically he loves Rothbard, but economically he swings more Chicago,
Right.
In practice, that's going to give us almost everything we want anyway.
Yeah, I agree. And I think you and I agree on that in general. When it comes to disputes or disagreements between Chicago and Austrian, let's achieve the things we agree on.
Yeah.
Okay, that'll give us real close. And then when that day comes, we'll sit down, have a beer, and then the next day we can fight over whatever's left. So
yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That is my, and I say that I'm not a wimp. I'm not a compromiser. But in a situation like this, I think we can all agree that whatever he goes ahead and slashes, it probably deserved to be slashed. So let him slash, and then we'll go to the next thing.
Yeah. Yeah. The true Scotsman thing, I think, is not helpful, right? Where everybody has to adopt the entire ideal all at once. You know, we got to privatize the roads and auction off the military and fund the government by bake sales. I love all of these things. However, I do accept that voters need to be brought with you. There's an Overton window of acceptable political views. You got to kind of ease voters over step by step. And so, yeah, I have enormous respect for him even coming in there and talking about closing the central bank, shutting down 60% of government spending is what he's promising. For even bringing that into the public conversation, and then if he achieves something like dollarization, from the perspective of the Argentinian people, I would count him as certainly Argentina's most successful leader this century, like for the past 100 years.
You ever been to Argentina?
I have. I lived there. Yeah, I lived there in the late 1990s. And there was actually a moment, this was in about a 10-year period where the peso and the dollar were parity. Okay, so they were $1 each. And I took a taxi and I gave the guy 10 pesos and he gave me change. It was $4, four $1 bills. And I was so happy when he did that because I thought Argentina is out of the woods. When the taxi driver is taking pesos and giving you dollars, you're safe. But it didn't last.
That's true. That's true. Well, that was one of the things I asked the young guy who lives in Argentina. What is it like living in a society that has 140% inflation? And he says, it's uppermost in your mind all the time.
Yes.
Yeah, you have in order to cope with it. You can't, it's not something that you can just discuss in a salon somewhere, but it's something you have to deal with all the time. And if he can put a stop to that, no one's going to care the details about his monetary policy if they can get, they almost won't even know what to do with themselves if they had stable prices.
Yeah. And I think we've got an analogous situation in El Salvador where the people, he came in promising legal tender for Bitcoin and that got, you know, a lot of people excited. And for me, that was exciting as well. But really, his major achievement, he's had one truly universal achievement, which is getting crime down in El Salvador, right? It's gone from one of the most dangerous countries on earth to one of the safest, certainly in Latin America. There is so much gratitude built into that kind of achievement that honestly, at this point, he could do anything, man. He could probably move El Salvador to the gold standard at this point because he is so popular. That's Bukele down in El Salvador. He's scoring over 90% in opinion polls. All right, so if Milei can slay inflation, and probably the fastest way to do it would be by dollarizing, if he can actually do that, I think he would have such a massive reservoir of goodwill that he would actually be able to do science fiction stuff, maybe slash government by half, maybe even move it over to gold.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Now, I don't know enough about politics in South America to be able to say, but you have to wonder if he really does work, not quite a miracle, but does accomplish something of note in Argentina. Does that lend political encouragement to copycat type figures in other countries? Or is it not replicable elsewhere?
If he does it by dollarizing, then yeah, I think you're absolutely right. There would be dozens of countries that would look to that as a model. We're seeing that with El Salvador on the crime, for example, where a lot of Latin American countries are looking to that. So certainly other Latin American countries suffering high inflation, such as Venezuela, would look to that. But you've got countries all over the world right now. You've got dozens of countries that have inflation rates around 40%. You've got a number in Africa, for example. And Argentina has a high profile. It's got a much higher profile than El Salvador, I think largely because of soccer. Countries all over the world, are all across Africa, are very aware of what's happening in Argentina. If he managed, and beyond which the most recent successful dollarization in Latin America has been 22 years ago. So it's not like in the public conversation. So I think that if he does manage to do that, and if you have this dramatic change, I think they'll absolutely serve as a model for many of these other countries. In a way, the timing would be perfect, because part of the reason why so many countries have this high inflation is, of course, how much money was printed really across the world, but particularly in the US and Europe. And so that's in sort of cascading down into these other countries. So this is sort of, the iron is hot. Okay, if you have a very successful reform that ends inflation, I think the iron is hot for a lot of these other countries, for political movements there to get inspired and maybe to make more fundamental reform in those countries too. Now, that may look like a whole bunch of dollarizations. And compared to what Nigerians or Ethiopians have to suffer, I think that would be a step in the right direction. And then you get that dollar milkshake, that dollar strengthening towards Ragnarok. But I think what it also does is that it plants the seed in people's mind that big things are possible, right? When you have some sort of large reform, I think the Overton does widen. People do start thinking about more fundamental reform. We see this every recession. For example, if you take the 2008 crisis, which was about banking policy or financial, it's about the financial industry. But actually, if you look at the regulation, for example, regulations just absolutely took off in pretty much every area you can imagine. It took off in global warming and workplace safety. It just took off on anything, right? Any kind of crisis, people start to open up. Now, usually that goes the wrong way, right? Because depending on what kind of government you have in power. But in this case, if that Overton window is opening up over some fundamental monetary reform, I think there's a chance that we could see that replicate in other countries.
Well, I want to somehow get people to follow you on Twitter. But the thing is that the thing you're seeing on your screen won't be there in the final version of this. So I'm going to say it. And if you can't remember it, you can go to tomwoods.com/2428 or look in the description of the video. But Peter's Twitter is Prof. St. Onge. So it's P-R-O-F, like professor, P-R-O-F, S-T-O-N-G-E. And go follow him there. And I don't know how many people are going to sit down and manually type that in. But if you do that, you're going to make me happy. You're going to make Peter happy. You're going to make yourself happy. I don't see what the downside is. So I want you to go ahead and do that. Looking forward to seeing you this weekend at the Christmas party that we're having
over
here.
Absolutely. Yes. Yes. It was a blast last year. And yeah, I'm really looking forward to this year again.
Thank you. Thank you. So you see, those of us who live in Central Florida, we have a good time together. You know, it's not a bad place to live. So come on down. All right. Thanks so much, Peter. I appreciate it.
Of course, Tom. Thank you.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.